we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. I'm Carol Davies McIntosh, and I'm joined today by Allison Cole.
Hi there, I'm on the controls, as usual.
And Namir Faraj.
Hello.
Welcome, Namir, and thanks for being our guest co-host today.
Today is Friday, September 6th. 2019, and it's the first week of school, which more about that later. We'd also like to give a warm welcome to a local Vancouverite who we are proud to say will be embarking on a vegan lifestyle. Her name is Dani, and she's a friend of Jen, our co-producer. This show is dedicated to and inspired by my five-year-old grandson, Georgie. Georgie started kindergarten this week. And as I look down the road in front of him, I see lots of landmines of anguish. He will likely encounter many cases of animal cruelty, both overt and covert, that will affect him. He will be irked, angered, and heartbroken by what he encounters in the school system. His schools will promote ice cream and hot dog days on sports day, keeping animals in cages and tanks as classroom pets, cutting up cow's eyes and frogs in the name of science. Last I checked, science is about discovery, not cruelty. George doesn't eat other animals. He eats plants. He wears plants. He's a sensitive soul like the other children in his class. He deserves better than this status quo. They deserve better. And more importantly, the other animals deserve better from us and from the school system. There are many alternatives to the cruel treatment of animals in our publicly funded schools, and we want to find and promote them. We also want to look at the idea of humane education. Humane education fosters compassion and empathy for others, including non-human animals, as one of its overarching goals. The framework asks educators and students to expand their definition of others to include non-human animals, teaching compassion. It looks at impacts humans have on the world, protection of habitats, and promotes kindness, giving students the skills that they really need to get more creative and create a more positive future. As Georgie and his class of 2032 begins their school life, I wish them luck, and I hope that we can help them to see a better future than what they are currently facing. And this means making some drastic changes. So over the next months, we will be featuring a school days segment once a month to try and find a way forward for the animals and for us all. So Georgie, go forth, young man, and be brave and kind. On the show today, in about 20 minutes, we have an interview with Andrew Hill, a team leader in Boys and Girls Clubs in Victoria. Not precisely a school, but a very influential job, as you will hear. And we haven't forgot the university students. In the last half of the show, we feature an interview with Jonathan Batchelor, an instructor at Washington University who speaks about environmental issues and our use of animals. To start off, we have a TED Talk with Zoe Weil. Zoe Weil is the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. She's been on the forefront of the development of modern humane education movement. Her Master's of Education program in Human Education covers the interconnected issues of human rights, animal protection, and environmental preservation. As we are really realizing more and more, these things are inextricably linked, impossible to separate, even though we have tried. Oh, how the human race has tried. Zoe has taught tens of thousands of students through her school presentations and has trained several thousand teachers through her workshops and programs. Ms. Weil has also written several books, including, above all, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. Animals in Society, Facts and Perspectives on Our Treatment of Animals, and Most Good, Least Harm, A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life, her signature MOGO principle. She sports a down-to-earth, simple approach to life and to the treatment of others, as you can tell by the title of her books. To start off the back-to-school series, we're playing her TED Talk entitled The World Becomes What You Teach, where she talks about a thought experiment called True Price. The MOGO, or Most Good Principle, means one has to look at the true costs of the goods that we use. So she asks, what are the effects of this item or process on other people, non-human animals, the environment, and yourself? And what alternatives to this product would do the most good and least harm to others, animals, and the environment? Have a listen.
When I was 15, I asked William Shatner, who played Captain Kirk on the original Star Trek series, to kiss 5,000 people at a Star Trek convention. Now, back then, Star Trek was probably the most important thing in my life. And like a lot of psychologists and sociologists at the time who were trying to understand the Star Trek phenomenon, I wanted to understand it too. I wanted to understand why this show and why these characters were so profoundly important to me that I would be willing to publicly humiliate myself as a 15-year-old. Well, I've given it a lot of thought, and I've come to the conclusion that the reason why Star Trek has so many millions of fans is because of the future that it depicts. A future in which we've solved our earthly problems. Our nations are at peace, our planet is alive and thriving, we're no longer myopic and mean-spirited, we're part of a United Federation of Planets. And we're actually explorers without being conquerors. That vision has actually kept me going when I felt my most despondent about the state of the world, which is easy to do in the face of global warming and escalating worldwide slavery and alarming rates of species extinction and war and poverty and genocide and institutionalized forms of oppression and cruelty toward both people and animals in a host of industries. It is very hard to imagine that we can actually create that Star Trek future. It seems so pie in the sky. And yet, I've spent my whole adult life working toward that future. And I've discovered the solution, and I'm going to share it with you today. There's actually just one system that we just need to tweak a little bit. And if we do that, we can solve every problem in the world. And that key system is schooling. Now, there's a deafening silence in the room. Because I realize that the word schooling is probably the most uninspiring word in the English language. But that's because we have a very small perception of what schooling can be. If we ask people, what's the purpose of schooling? Most of them are going to say something like this. Well, it's to provide the basics of verbal, mathematical, and scientific literacy so that our graduates can find jobs and compete in the global economy. So let's do a thought experiment. Let's imagine that every child graduates from high school and does so having passed their No Child Left Behind tests with flying colors. And let's imagine further that every single one of them is able to find a decent job paying a livable wage, or go to college and find such a job, or go to college and graduate school and find such a job, so that we have 100% employment. Would we think that we had been successful in our goals for schooling? Well, I think that most of us would say yes. The problem is that many of those graduates would go on to perpetuate and perhaps even exacerbate some of those problems that I just mentioned earlier. The problem is that that purpose is too small and it's outmoded for today's world. We need a bigger vision for the purpose of schooling. And I believe that it should be this, that we provide every student with the knowledge, the tools, and the motivation to be conscientious choice makers and engaged change makers for a restored and healthy and humane world for all. Or another way of putting it, I believe that we need to graduate a generation of solutionaries. Now, some people have asked, well, is this good for kids? And is it really fair to them to burden them with the responsibility to fix all the problems that generations before them have created? Well, to answer those questions, I want to tell you some stories about my experience as a humane educator, somebody who teaches about the interconnected issues of human rights and environmental preservation and animal protection. I became a humane educator back in 1987 when I was looking for a summer job, and I found this program that was offering week-long courses to middle school students in Philadelphia. So that's where I taught my first humane education courses. And I watched in amazement as these kids were transformed over the course of a week, in one case, overnight. I had taught about product testing on animals one day, and I talked about how soaps and lotions and oven cleaner are squeezed into the eyes of conscious rabbits and force-fed to them in quantities that kill. And a boy from the class went home that night, and he made his own homemade leaflets about product testing. Well, he came into class the next morning, and he showed them to me, and he asked if he could hand them out. And I said, sure. I thought he wanted to hand them out to his fellow classmates. He wanted to hand them out on the street. So while the rest of us were having lunch, he was on a Philadelphia street corner handing out his leaflets. He'd become an activist overnight. Actually, several of the kids in that class became activists. Two of them formed a Philadelphia area-wide student group that went on to win awards for their great work. Well, that was the summer I realized that I'd found my life's work as a humane educator, and I went on to form a humane education program where I brought presentations and courses into schools. And there was one school, a public high school, where I did an after-school course. And there was a boy in the class named Mike. He was a senior, and he always sat near the front. He was really smart. He always played devil's advocate, which I loved, because I want my students to be critical thinkers above all else. In fact, I often begin presentations by telling students, don't believe a word I say. Well, I still worried about Mike. I worried whether or not I was really reaching him, because he never had an emotional response to any of the issues that we were discussing, and they were some pretty intense issues. Well, on the last day of class, I decided to do a rather unconventional activity called the Council of All Beings, where I invited the students to become, through their imaginations, another being, whether a part of nature or another animal or another person, and then to speak as this being and talk about what's happening to them and talk about what they want to change and share their wisdom. So I was really worried, how is Mike going to react to this kind of touchy-feely activity? But my fears were totally unfounded. Mike had become the ocean. And when he spoke, poetry just poured out of his mouth. I was stunned. Well, when the activity was over, that was the end of the course, and we were saying our goodbyes. And Mike said, thank you, Zoe. When I look back on high school, this is what I'm going to remember. So yes, I believe this form of education is good for kids. Is it fair to them? Well, to answer that question, I want to tell you another story. A couple of years ago, I was asked to be the speaker at the National Honor Society induction at a local high school. And I did an activity with the audience called True Price, in which we look at an everyday object, like bottled water or a fast food cheeseburger, and ask, what is the true price of this item on ourselves as individuals, on other people, on other species, and on the environment? Well, that particular day, I did True Price with a t-shirt. And I'm going to do a little bit of this activity with you. So what are the effects, both positive and negative, of this item on me as a consumer, on other people, on animals, and on the environment? Well, questions like those could be somebody's dissertation. So to answer them today, I'm just going to scratch the surface. Well, the first thing I need to do to answer those questions is look at the item itself. So I'm going to look at the label and see what it has to tell me. Well, I found out when I looked at this label that it's 100% cotton, it's made in China, and I learn how to launder it. I also learn that it's dry cleanable in case I would like to spend $6 to clean my t-shirt. So that doesn't tell me very much. I'm going to have to dig a little bit deeper. And if I do some research into cotton and cotton t-shirts, I'm going to find out that cotton is a crop that is heavily sprayed with pesticides, many of which are toxic. And we know they're toxic because of incredibly cruel tests that were done on animals to test them. We also discover that many of those pesticides end up polluting our soil and our waterways. Now, if I find out a little bit more about cotton, I will come across some information that it's estimated that a third of cotton is produced in Uzbekistan, where by another estimate, there are 1 million children working in those fields as slaves. Now, that cotton, after it's grown, has to be turned into cloth, and then it has to be dyed, because it didn't get to be this red color out of the ground. So if I do some research on the dye, I discover that many of those dyes are also toxic and also wind up in our water stream, because about 30% of the dye doesn't adhere to the cotton, and it winds up in the water. Then, of course, the cloth has to go somewhere to be turned into a t-shirt, and we know that it went to China. So if we did a little research on Chinese garment factories, we would discover that there, many of them, are essentially sweatshops, where people are working exceedingly long hours under terrible working conditions. And then finally, it's going to be transported using lots of fossil fuels so that I can buy it. So those are just some of the effects and some of the negative effects. The positive ones are a little bit easier to see. We know that even if there was slave labor involved in this, it certainly did contribute to a lot of people having jobs. And it's produced in a way that's inexpensive so that I can get lots of these in all different colors and shapes and styles, some of which might look cute on me, which might make me feel good about myself. So there are some positive effects. Now, we ask two other important questions in True Price. We ask, what alternatives would do more good and less harm than this conventional product? And what are the systems that would need to be transformed in order to make those alternatives ubiquitous? Well, after the talk was over, a colleague of mine asked one of the inductees what she thought of it. And she said that it made her really angry because, and this is a quote, "We should have been learning this since kindergarten." I agree. So in answer to the question, do I think that it's fair to provide this form of education to our students? I actually think it's unfair not to provide the knowledge and the skills to our students, to our children, so that they can be solutionaries for a better world. Now, let's say we were to actually embrace this larger purpose for schooling. What would our schools look like? Well, first of all, any of these objects could be a course in a school. And it would be a course that would be relevant to our students' lives and their future and their health and the health of their planet. And all of the basics would serve that course, because in the process of answering those questions, we would be studying math and science, and history, and social studies, and economics, and politics, and language arts, and many other subjects. We could have overarching themes for each year of school. One year it might be food and water, another year it could be energy and transportation, another year it could be buildings and structures, another year it could be protection and conflict resolution. We can't live without all of those things. So what if the basics were in service to figuring out how we could make all of those systems as humane and sustainable and peaceful and just as possible? Last year I was driving my car and I was listening to NPR on the radio, and there was a report about an Oxford-style debate that was being conducted at New York University. And the subject of the debate was this question: is the United States responsible for Mexico's drug woes? Now, I remember sitting in my car thinking, that's really a bizarre question. Because how could anything as complicated as Mexico's drug woes be reduced to an either-or question about another nation's culpability? It seemed a bizarre question, but it got me thinking about all of the debate teams in all of the schools where kids are arbitrarily assigned one side or another of a fabricated either-or scenario, and they're taught to research it, and they're told to argue it and win. To what end? What if instead of having debate teams, we had solutionary teams? We had students tackling problems and competing, because we love to do that. But we have them competing about who could come up with the most viable, cost-effective, innovative solutions to those problems. Those problems could be ones in their own school, they could be ones in their community, they could be ones that are global problems. And those students could compete within their schools, and then they could compete with other local schools, and then they could go to states, and then the really brilliant ideas, we could implement them. Imagine what would happen. Imagine what would happen if we embraced this vision of schooling. And what would our graduates go on to do? Well, they would do the same thing that graduates do today. They'd be business people and healthcare providers and plumbers and engineers and architects and beauticians and politicians. The difference would be they would perceive themselves as solutionaries. They would know that it was their responsibility to ensure that the systems within their profession were just and humane and peaceful. Why? Because that is what they would have learned in school. And if we were to succeed in actually embracing this vision, and if we were to succeed in educating a generation of solutionaries, then there is no doubt in my mind that we could solve every single problem that we face. And when we would watch that happen rapidly and inexorably by this generation of solutionaries. And then, perhaps, that Star Trek world that I and so many millions of people long for could actually come to pass.
After letting Zoe Weil set the tone for humane educators, I went out to find said educators. Earlier this week, I spoke with Andrew Hill, who is a team leader with Boys and Girls Clubs in their before and after school care and also in their summer programs. He works with kids from kindergarten to grade 5, so about 5 to 11 years old. Andrew is also an animal rights activist and is very sensitive to animal rights issues that come up during his time with the children. I asked him what type of ethical conflicts he encounters at work with the kids.
Well, programming itself, you know, on professional development days, we take the kids on trips to different places. In the summer, we take the kids on a trip almost every single day. And, you know, typical programming with clubs and schools involves taking kids to petting zoos and taking kids to aquariums and, you know, taking kids out into nature and stuff like that. And you're constantly running into, the concept that, you know, humans, have some sort of right to use animals in some sense. So it's something that you run into a lot there, certainly. And you run up against the agency in creating that programming as well as someone who's running a club.
So it's clear that discounting or perhaps not even noticing animal harm is a systemic issue. He gave me an example of taking the kids to the beach and also talking to the other team leads.
You know, it sounds so simple, but, you know, we take the kids to the beach. And when you take a young kid to the beach, you know, the first thing they want to do is they want to go and find crabs and pick them up and play with them and stuff like that. The very first thing, you know, we run into is me telling kids that they can't do that. And then kind of having to explain why. And that's pretty simple with just one club. But then when we combine clubs and other team leads without that kind of concept of animals, you know, not being here for us, other team leads are letting their kids do that kind of stuff. I had kids from our other clubs come over to me with buckets full of crabs and want to tell me about all the crabs they caught. And I have to go to their team lead, who is kind of my equal, and say, I don't let my kids do that. You know, that's not something my club is allowed to do. And if you're going to allow your kids to do that, they are going to need to not be including our kids in those activities.
I asked him if the kids understood why they were not allowed to collect crabs and if they asked him questions about it.
Kids are great at asking questions, and they don't get enough credit, I think, for their ability to internalize this kind of stuff and think it through. I stay really kid-friendly with it, but I just say, well, would we let you put a bird in a bucket? And they say, well, no, of course not. And I say, well, there's no difference between a crab and a bird. You know, the crab's just living their life. And how would you feel if you were just living your life and someone came along and picked you up and threw you in a bucket and then dumped you out somewhere else where you don't know anyone and it's not your home and, you know, you were probably doing things before they threw you in the bucket? And kids pretty quickly, they kind of go, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, yeah, I wouldn't stick a dog in a bucket, so why would I put a crab in?
Andrew also mentioned that the kids often not only learn and understand why they are to treat animals well and with respect, but also they will monitor other kids and advocate for the animals. He believes that they are naturally compassionate and mainly just need to be shown the way. He talked about how he thinks that advocating for animals impacts his colleagues.
And honestly, in that the situation where I had to speak to the other team lead, they just haven't thought it through. And so once I say we have to think about the larger implication of what we're teaching these kids, and we have to ask ourselves if we want to teach the kids in our club that animals are toys, is that a lesson we want to teach them? And, you know, the rest of the kids in that person's club, they weren't allowed to pick up crabs that day either. There's a huge ripple effect when one person stands up and says, wait a second, let's take a bigger look at the lesson that we're teaching kids here.
In addition, Andrew told me that he has declined to take his groups to the petting zoo on ethical grounds and does talk to his colleagues and the kids about mistreatment of animals in these situations. He's connected with the rescue farm Rasta on Vancouver Island and was able to explain to his colleagues that after the baby goats leave the petting zoo, someone has to find them forever homes. And often this is not easy. Rasta has just taken in two of those baby goats. Interestingly, Andrew has never had a parent say anything good or bad about advocating for animals. Next time in the School Day series, we'll talk to an elementary school teacher, James, who has had quite a different kind of experience.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
And for the university crowd, here's an interview with Jonathan Batchelor. Thanks for joining us today on Animal Voices, Jonathan. Can you just tell us what you teach and where?
I'm a PhD student at the University of Washington in the School of Environmental and Forest Sciences. And sort of the field in the classes. I'm an instructor and teaching assistant for reside in sort of the forest ecology, remote sensing, and sort of how to detect forest change, forest health remotely.
So how do you see your role as an educator?
Well, I came back into academia and stepped in here after many, many years engaging in sort of environmental activism, environmental advocacy role, and spent a lot of time standing on picket lines, like saying, look, all this research is showing how we're destroying the planet and you need to listen to it. And I kind of decided that instead of just being a person that was standing on the front lines, like yelling about all this research, I'd try to step into the academic role and pursue some research that might have some sort of meaningful impact as well, and sort of like change direction a little bit. And so hopefully I'm filling a niche where I'm presenting a viewpoint to students that is outside sort of the typical academic narrative of just sort of marching this society or civilization along and sort of calling into question some of the paradigms and assumptions about, and saying, well, hey, we should be looking at more holistically about environmental impacts and what we as individuals and people can be doing, and a more ecocentric viewpoint in the environmental science sort of venue.
Do you find that you're at odds with your university with that viewpoint?
I don't think so. I think the university, we talk about a lot of the same, a lot of our positions we hold are very similar. I find there's sometimes a disconnect between sort of what we say and how we live our lives.
Right.
And the universities, and this is absolutely not, this is not only University of Washington at all, but just education in general. We talk about this impending environmental collapse and humanity's footstep and our impact on the environment, but we sort of aren't willing to take that step to sort of be more critical about our own consumption patterns, mm-hmm. and sort of like bringing that into that narrative and critical viewpoint into sort of a classroom environment. It's great to talk about, you know, the climate impacts of deforestation or climate impacts of animal agriculture, but the moment you sort of question the intrinsic sort of viewed right of someone to consume animal products, then that's gone too far, and that's a sort of a taboo subject.
I think that's in more than just in education, but I feel that the education process needs to be more honest, that's where a lot of change in society starts. You were part of a study that assessed about 1,000 square kilometer area. So that's, I don't know what that is in miles, but I'm Canadian, so I'm going to use kilometers.
No, I prefer kilometers.
Okay.
Certainly.
It was formerly used for grazing cattle. And you went in, I think it was 23 years after it was turned into a refuge, an antelope refuge, and you looked at the results of having taken the cattle off that land. Can you speak to the results that you found?
Yeah, we sort of refer to it as passive restoration processes. And so what that means is that if you remove some impacting factor in this instance, it was cattle, and basically largely leave the system alone. How does it respond? There were some prescribed burning and some small management that was in this area, but largely it was left to its own progression. And we had all these historical photos that we were going back and re-photographing all these stream channels. And the original photographs were taken to document the stream channel degradation and all of these impacts that were from the cattle grazing. Cattle grazing can compact the soils and mm-hmm. sort of like to prevent sort of water penetration into the soils.
Right.
It erodes the stream banks, sort of it detaches the hydrology from a system, so streams can become sort of unglued and meander and just cause massive erosion, which impacts, you know, fish habitat and all these things. And willow were just completely gone from large portions of these streams.
Willow trees?
And,
willow?
Yeah, well, it's more, yeah, willow trees, but more sort of in a shrub or bush form, which are incredibly important for, you know, shading of the riparian systems. And we came back and we wanted to see that there's a lot of conversation about how, you know, restoration and of degraded ecosystems. But a lot of times, the only thing a system needs is for this sort of this anthropogenic forcing, which represented by cows in this case, to be removed to start regenerating itself. And we saw the stream banks were starting to stabilize, become vegetated. There was huge willow growth. There were like a lot of fish in the streams where they had been like absent before. And it was just a perfect example of how systems can change just with sort of the removal of cows in this case. Mm-hmm. And that sort of has huge cascading impacts, influences throughout the system. When you have these riparian systems coming back in vegetation, fish coming back into the streams, thinking about the carbon sequestration represented by these more intact streams.
So it seems to me that this sort of research is extremely important in light of our climate catastrophe. And I'm interested in whether there were links made between your results and the use of animals for food.
No, I mean, absolutely. Just in as much as, I mean, that's why the cattle are being grazed in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's for beef. A professor at Oregon State University, Dr. William Ripple, who was my advisor, also, after that study, released another study looking at the required food and ultimate carbon footprint of sort of like the free-range cattle, this ideal of of free-range cattle versus sort of confined animal feeding operations. And he actually was looking at it like pound for pound, these free-ranging cows actually have more of a carbon footprint than sort of the intensely farmed cows. Not to say that either one is better, but it's just pointing out that this idea of this free-range cattle is not environmentally like sound.
That's really interesting. So their carbon footprint is actually higher than a factory farm.
Yeah, and there's a narrative coming from people sort of touting this idea of this holistic resource management of using cows as a restoration method of saying, oh, we should be putting more cows onto the landscape, because if they are moved in a way that mimics sort of the native ungulate populations, you can actually start restoring sort of the grassland. And this is, I think, it's a little crap. And
why would they say that?
Well, it's largely the evidence supporting this position is purely anecdotal. They're looking at systems that have been heavily impacted by cattle grazing and changing the behavior of the cattle. And they're like, oh, hey, if this area that's already been heavily impacted, if we change the power grazing, it can come back and like it can start sort of revegetating and look better. But they're ignoring the question of what happens if you just remove the cattle from the system. And more importantly, because a lot of systems in North America sort of evolved with large ungulate populations like bison. And so with the extirpation of bison, with their complete removal of this very important apex consumer, they think that they can sort of like stand cows in as sort of replacements for bison.
For bison.
Something that's more, that's more marketable. But they're trying to do this process sort of in Washington and Oregon on the west side that didn't have historic bison populations. And it's largely just sort of a gimmick where people can still sort of raise cows for slaughter and then feel like they're somehow doing some ecological good in that. But it's not like they're just missing that entire slice of, like, they're not willing to question their sort of assumed right to these animals in the animals' lives.
Yes.
That they can't question that privilege of like, oh, well, this animal is here for me. And so they're looking for solutions that they don't actually have to change their consumption pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And it just falls apart so quickly if you sort of like start scratching at it a little bit. I have a lot of questions. I've had talked with quite a few ranchers about this topic. And I'm like, well, you're bringing these cattle in as sort of a stand-in for bison. But what if you just brought bison back? Why don't we actually just start trying to move away from these artificial landscapes that are we've created and actually allow bison the free range and allow the wolves free range and try to view how we interact with nature as more of how can we have cities or towns or that sort of exist inside the confines of nature as opposed to changing it whole scale. And that concept is just so foreign to so many people.
People don't want to live in harmony with their surroundings, their natural surroundings. They want to control.
Yeah, it's control and dominate.
Mm-hmm. Those studies, do they get used to promote a different lifestyle or a different way of looking at our environment and then the climate issues and that sort of thing?
Well, I would hope so. It's interesting to me. I mean, even like the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has released study after study about sort of the impacts of animal agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was one that was fairly recently, because there's like the Livestock's Long Shadow that came out a few years ago that was comparing that sort of came to the conclusion that animal agriculture was more responsible than all transport globally combined for CO2, equivalent emissions. And I think a more recent one came up where I'm not sure about the numbers off the top of my head, but I believe like 50% of all vegetated land has been turned to agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And 30% of that is geared towards animal feed.
Yeah.
And so we keep bringing out these numbers but still, even in the institutions that are like putting out this research and the studies, it's still really hard to get people to start questioning their own consumption patterns and being like, okay, well, if we're having either United Nations or a university somewhere, we're having a presentation or workshop about climate change, but you know, the only food that's being served is beef, not to necessarily solely focus on cows because it's animal agriculture as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they're like serving cheese pizzas, you know,
right,
it's still contributing into that
chicken
sort of,
exactly.
Yeah, those blinders.
Is that something that you can discuss with your students?
I try to.
What kind of reaction do you get from them?
I recently had a student tell me that they were going to try to eat more vegetables for me. So,
well, that's good.
That's something. Yeah. I think within the confines of an academic setting, I have very strong views on this. I still feel like a responsibility to present it in a fairly objective manner to students. This is some of the impacts, and this is some of the sources. So you have to make up your own mind about this.
So if you present the facts and the study results, does it lead them to, or do they lead themselves into thinking that they maybe need to change their consumption patterns?
I hope so. And I know it's a personal journey, I suppose, for every person.
Mm-hmm.
But at least encountering voices in a learning environment where you're talking, like where those kind of conversations are at least brought up, will hopefully, you know, at least provide students a fuller picture to make their decisions on.
Are there some universities that are a little more on point with that type of thing in terms of making the linkages between our use of animals for food and climate change, do you think?
Well, I think London College just banned beef not too long ago.
Okay.
I believe that was London, a UK university.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the step, the diversity within larger universities. I think you'll find sort of more smaller groups or smaller schools or organizations inside universities that are starting, that sort of are the forerunners of this change. Mm-hmm. I think that's true as a whole, but it's a question, is trying to get these from these small little holdouts into sort of a university-wide policy, which is really, really difficult.
Right.
I've been trying to have conversations, and I'll see how effective it becomes. But just swapping, just sort of like question that paradigm that, you know, if something is catered, it has to be like very meat focused. I mean, this whole idea of having meat for every meal is an incredibly, you know, American, like Eurocentric sort mm-hmm. of privileged idea. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, you know, swapping that and saying, okay, like maybe the first step is, all the catered meals will be largely plant-based but, you know, you can have something to put on it that might not be vegan, but sort of that might be questioning this assumption of what is an appropriate food for a group.
Mm-hmm. Right.
as odd as that sounds. And I think how we interact with people, and what's most appropriate is totally dependent on the venue, like how I discuss sort of these topics and something with a student is very different than I might be talking, putting a more active advocacy like role on and mm-hmm. engaging with someone on the street or something.
Right.
And so it's trying to be appropriate to the context that you're in.
Right.
One thing though, I think that needs to be moved away from is this idea of oh well, we have to show both sides of the story. And while that's true in many, many cases, just thinking about like climate change.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a panel on climate change now, no longer are people saying, oh well, we have to have both sides of this climate change story like represented. And so we're going to give equal weight to like a climate change denier
right.
as we are to a climate change.
So that's changed, has it?
I feel, well, at least in my circle, that's changed. Well, I mean, governmental policy, depending on probably who you're talking about, they might still try to pull that crap.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But I don't, hopefully we're getting to the point where we're talking about animal agriculture. We're not going to be like, oh, well, we have to see both sides of the story, because hopefully the objective facts are pointing out more and more that animal agriculture is just not a sustainable mm-hmm. or environmentally responsible thing to have. Hopefully we're getting away from the point like, well, we can actually just talk about the destructive impact of animal agriculture, even in an academic setting, without trying to pander to this holdout minority that somehow think that you can use cows as a way for restoration.
So you're seeing movement and you're seeing some change. I guess, is it fast enough?
No. Yeah, I don't think at this point, given that the fact of how far down this road we are mm-hmm. of climate change, and just the fact that we're still even having this conversation at this point doesn't give me necessarily a lot of hope for the future.
Right.
But I guess that doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying.
I think a lot of us are in that position where we're feeling despondent one day and we're back at the fight the next day because we don't want to give up.
No.
So thanks for sharing your ideas with us today, Jonathan, and thanks for not giving up.
Thank you for not giving up as well.
And now we have an event coming up from Namir.
I am here to talk about the Animals in Science Policy Institute. The website is animalsinscience.org. Essentially, Animals in Science Policy Institute is a Canadian registered charity. Their slogan is, "We are committed to promoting better science without animals." So if you want to become a humane science educator, this is the place to go. They allow you to explore alternative methods to research, testing, and education that requires non-animal study methods. Research shows it is more effective at educating than dissection. There are other benefits as well, like obviously being more humane and ethical. It is less messy. It's definitely more green and way less costly. The first class is 100% free. That's right, 100% free. Subsequent classes are by donation on a sliding scale, $50 to $200 per class. There are three classes total, 60 to 90 minutes each, and you get to keep the class plan and other resources. It's highly student-centered. The three courses are comparative anatomy class from kindergarten to grade 12, single species class from grade 8 to 12, and human anatomy class from grade 10 to 12. Each station has a virtual dissection and anatomy station on iPads. They also give you a detailed paper dissection, 3D models, and more. If you would like to learn more and teach about animal life cycle and some human anatomy, how body system works, adaptation, etc., and you want to do it in a humane way, please visit animalsandscience.org. That's Animals and Science.
Thank you, Namir. And I have a story that I would like to add myself about using education, perhaps promoting farming, animal farming in schools, because we see that sometimes, don't we?
There's
this mobile dairy that will go to schools. And mm-hmm. now, as of this week, I discovered this educational mini barn this week that's called Poultry in Motion when I was at the PNE. That's the Pacific National Exhibition that happens every summer for 2 weeks in Vancouver. And I was going to go into the barn to see the animals there because what it is the 4-H kids will raise their animals and then they will send them off to slaughter, which I don't think usually they even realize what they're doing, which is another topic to be discussed. And I'd like to discuss that on another show.
But love to.
Yeah, so I was going to walk into the barn, see if there's any animals left there. And I actually didn't get that far because I came upon this educational mini barn. And it's presented by the BC Chickens Grower Association and the BC Broiler Hatching Egg Producers Association in an effort to educate consumers and increase awareness about chicken farming in BC. And they say that this fully equipped mini barn has been featured at fairs, schools, and agricultural events around the province. So what this mini educational barn consisted of were, it was all encased in sort of like a glass or plastic closures, and it was a three-part. They're saying that they're showing the three sections of each stage of development of a broiler hen. So in the first box, and there were actual real chickens in this space.
Of course.
In the first box, they showed the breeding part, which I had never actually seen that before. There were really huge chickens in that section, and they're explaining that the rooster and the hen breeds. And then they breed to make chicks for the broiler industry, of course, right? Baby chicks. And so the next enclosure had these baby chicks in them, a whole lot of them, which were really cute, you know. And then the third enclosure had had basically chickens who are 5 weeks old or 45 days old, and they're ready to be sent in their pamphlet. They say that they're ready to be shipped where? I wasn't told, but we know where they're shipped, because the fourth stage they actually didn't include was transport and slaughter, right? So I had a really good sort of lengthy conversation with a young woman there who was a farmer herself, had other animals at her farm, and was representing chicken farming. And I just want to, I know we're short for time here, but I just want to end this by saying that, you know, I feel that it's pretty sad to see that this kind of display and like the dairy, mobile dairy farm that I know they have, will be taken to classrooms and schools in BC here. And that's something that I feel is the industry is indoctrinating young children.
Absolutely.
From as soon as they can, to let them think that chicken farming or dairy farming is normal, natural, and necessary, and that this is the way it happens. The girl who I was speaking with, she was really good PR for a PR person for the industry, and you know, I shot about 50 questions at her, probably a lot that she wasn't expecting, a lot of knowledge she probably wasn't expecting. I was like, what about this and what about that? We don't have time to get into it, but I can tell you for sure, I checked my facts afterwards, and some of the things she was telling me were not true. So, you know, watch out for that in the industry and in your classrooms, and if you have kids especially. And I know we'll be talking more about that in future months as you continue your series.
We will.
So
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for pointing that out. I'm reading your pamphlet actually, and it's pretty scary because they actually want to come to your classrooms and events and explain, or I guess lie to you how this is done.
Yeah.
And just so you know, the marketing board for this is I think it's paid by us, funny enough, the taxpayers.
Taxpayers, yeah. I've
been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Please join us for next week's show on Friday, September the 13th, as the annual hunt season of dolphins in Japan has just reopened as of last Sunday. We will bring updates on that issue next week, as well as the slaughter of whales in the Faroe Islands, which we last covered on the show in 2012 and is still happening today. We here at the Animal Voices Show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. Our past shows can be listened to on our website at animalvoices.org. Our past podcasts are also available on iTunes and Google Play. Join our Facebook page and join us now on Instagram, both at Animal Voices Vancouver.
To end the show, we're playing Georgie's favorite song, Shut Up and Dance by Walk the Moon. And Georgie, you owe me a dance.
Oh, don't you dare look back, just keep